president of the Clara Fund, and I will be your moderator tonight. And before we get started, if I could take a few moments and talk a little bit about the Council for those of you who are new to the program. The World Affairs Council of Northern California, it provides a forum for leaders across all sectors to engage in dialogue with members of the public, to deepen understanding on a number of issues, and in that way, to create a basis for more informed action. You can visit our website on itsyourworld.org, and if you can't make it to one of our events, you can stay connected in two ways. There is a Monday evening radio program on KQED, and you can also log on to the website, and you can download audio or video of programs that we have presented. There are note cards on your seats, and these are for your questions. So as Keith and Matt are speaking, please feel free to note your questions, and one of the representatives from the council will collect them, and I will read them. And since I'm going to read them, I encourage you to write big, because, well, anybody over 45 in the audience will appreciate that request. So I think those are the housekeeping bits. Let me give you just a little bit more background on Matt and Keith, and then we'll get started. Matt and Keith will both speak for a few minutes about their organizations and their business models, and then we'll open it up to questions from all of you. So we're looking at two business models for giving, or two models for giving. One is micro loans, and one is micro grants. So let me start by giving a little, tiny bit more information about Matt, and then I'll give a tiny bit more about Keith. So Matt Flannery started working on Kiva in 2004 when he was working at TiVo full time, sort of as a side project. And in 2005, decided to make the move full time to Kiva, and since then, sort of went from this pilot project to this online service that is impacting, you know, hundreds of thousands of folks around the globe, with partners around the globe, through micro loans. Keith started his organization. He was actually teaching English at Middle Tennessee State University, and decided to start a personal project where he would commit a certain amount of his income to helping folks in his community, working individuals and their families through these small grants. And he launched a website, an anonymous website, and the response was overwhelming, and mostly from folks who were potential donors. And so he's taken his personal project and created Modest Needs Foundation, and the foundation supports families that find themselves in small economic crises with nowhere else to turn, and provides micro grants for these folks. So with that, Matt, perhaps you can kick it off for us and talk a little bit about your organization and your model.
Sure. Thanks a lot, everyone, for showing up. It's really a pleasure to be able to speak here tonight. My face is radiating joy of sunburn, because I was, I think it's a big step for Kiva, the organization, as a small nonprofit, to take a day off and go to the Giants game, which is a big sign of something, maybe the sign of the apocalypse or something, the fact that their entire nonprofit was at a baseball game and the website still ran. So that was really special yesterday. But being sort of not a wealthy organization, we got the bleacher seats. So there's no cover, and I'm a little bit obstinate, or I was trying to make a stand against the sunscreen, and I think the sun won. So everyone else was using sunscreen except me in the audience. But anyway, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about Kiva, the organization that I started with my co-founder, Jessica, in about 2004. Really quick, what Kiva is, it's an online marketplace for lending. So you can lend money to a micro entrepreneur in one of 51 countries. So we were up to 50 countries until recently, and we just started working in the USA, where you can actually make a loan to someone else in San Francisco now, or somebody in New York as well. But the idea was, there's all these, you know, entrepreneurs all over the world that need small loans, and there's all these microfinance institutions all over the world that service them, but they're very small. And why not tap into the internet as a source of funding for them? And so we created a website where an MFI, an organization that lends to poor people, can post up the business plans of their clients, put them on the website, and people like you and I can fund them from the USA. And it took a long time to figure out how to make that work and how to make it work well. So we use PayPal, sites sort of using PayPal as a payment processing engine, and we get that service for free. And people are sending little bits of money all over the world, and it's going out and it's coming back and it's recycling. And we've, in about 4 years, we've funded about $80 million in loans this way, $25 at a time, from over 500,000 people. So it's really something that caught on and changed my life and made me lose a lot of sleep. But I've learned a lot, and it's been a good experience. We now have staff all over the world, and we do a lot of due diligence. So we've had to create sort of an international risk brain center, so to speak, where we're doing a lot of due diligence all over the world on who we can send money to and how much money we can send to that MFI so that we don't send too much money to one place. We've had times where we've grown so fast that all of a sudden we flood our partners with money, and sometimes that can be a little bit overwhelming. So we've learned how to moderate that flow through doing a lot of auditing and a lot of credit scoring and due diligence work. So I've learned a lot about financial transparency in the process of Kiva. So anyway, that's sort of a rambling description of what we do, and there's a lot more to talk about. So I'll let Keith talk about Modest Needs, and then we'll have questions after that.
Well, again, thank you all for coming out. And I have to say, it's the very idea that I would be here talking at the World Affairs Council over something that I thought was going to be me giving away a few $100 a month is just beyond ridiculous. Okay, it's just really a wonderful thing, and it's nice to meet all of you. And it's good to finally meet Matt. You know, mm-hmm. We've known each other's work for a long time and had opportunities to meet that have passed. So this is a good moment. Modest Needs is best explained through example, I think. Really, it is also an online marketplace, but the people that we work with are persons that you would classify as the working poor, people who in the United States primarily are employed, are doing everything that they can to support themselves, and yet have no access to conventional types of social services. Okay. Now, if you've ever been in a position like that where you were making just enough money to live, but not enough money to save, then you know that even a small unexpected event can absolutely sideline you. And in fact, that's how most of the people that end up qualifying for social services end up qualifying for those services. There's a small event that takes place, and they just don't have access to any organization, any program that will help them. Because, you know, this is just a small example, things that I've learned over the course of doing this. Owning a car in many states will simply disqualify you from the whole process. That's too much of an asset to qualify for social services, which is, you know, be that as it may, that's the way that it goes. So Modest Needs really started as a result of my gratitude, just an extraordinary moment of gratitude for the people who had helped me when I had been in those situations. Now, you heard I was teaching English. Actually, it was much more specific than that. And you will immediately see how microfinance and entrepreneurship came into this. I was teaching medieval British lit. My specialty was translating old English. Okay, so I was the Beowulf guy, right? And that's what I was doing when Modest Needs started. And I have to tell you, I loved that job. I loved it. It was one of the best jobs. Before this, it was the best job that I ever had. And one day, I was doing this in Nashville. I was teaching just outside of Nashville. I was driving. I lived in downtown Nashville, 30 minutes away, so I could live in the city. And I drove to the college town, right, and did my gig and went home. And one night, I was driving home. I had about a 30-minute commute. And I started to just think about the number of times in my life that I had come this close to losing my apartment, or losing my car, or not being able to go to the doctor when I was legitimately sick and didn't have health insurance. Because, you know, if you've ever been a grad student, or if you're a grad student now, I mean, that's the life of a grad student. It was a nasty, 10 years between master's and PhD and everything else. And so I started to think about a specific incident, and just to make it very brief, I came very, very close to losing my apartment when I was in my, right at the end of my PhD, because my car, I was going to school at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville because that was the place to go for medieval studies, right? So that's where I was. And we had no public transportation. We had no way to get around. You had to have a car. That was it. And my car, I know nothing about cars. My car had two, you know, operational modes. Works, does not work, right? And I went out to start my car, and it didn't work. And to make a long story short, it ended up being a $500-and-something repair. That was the cost of my rent. So I had to choose whether I was going to fix the car or whether I was going to, you know, pay my rent and then figure out how I was going to get around with no transportation. And so I fixed the car, deciding that perhaps I could find a way to get this money back, right? You know, if I had a car, I could go out and do something else and get this money back, and it didn't turn out that way. And I was working a side job, as many people did. I was a projectionist in a movie theater, the ultimate job for writing a dissertation because you work for 5 minutes every 2 hours, right? And you just write the rest of the time. And my boss found out what had happened. I didn't want to tell him because, frankly, it's humiliating when you have to say to somebody that your life has come down to $500. You know, it's really, that's not so good. He found out. And the next day I came in, and there was a check made out to my landlord sitting on the workbench. And that's how I didn't get evicted. And I was thinking about that driving home. And I thought to myself, the way I think most people think about philanthropy, I thought, you know what, I'm really wealthy. Because that's how every discussion I have with people, you know, is you know, when I'm wealthy, this is what I'd like to do. I'd like to start a program that does that same thing for other people in exactly that position. And what occurred to me all of a sudden is that indeed, even in Greek, there's no money in the word philanthropy. It means compassion for people. And that's what I thought. You know what? None of the people who ever helped me had any money. They cared about me. And I thought, that's what I've missed all of these years. And I downsized my life and just made a commitment that I was going to take $350 a month and find one person that I could help in that way. Just one person. And that is really how Modest Needs started. Now, of course, it's grown substantially, and we are very much a giving marketplace where individual people across the United States come to us. We work in Canada as well, but don't see nearly as many applications as we do from the U.S. They come to us. They explain to us what the situation is. We do a significant amount of due diligence, and then we allow, once we've validated what the people have told us, we allow individuals across the country to contribute to these specific causes. It's really interesting. It's the first time that the IRS has ever allowed an organization to let people donate directly to individuals through that organization for a tax exemption, and we had to work very hard to get that, but we got it. That is what we do. It's a very simple, easy model. You know, you can track your progress. It's, you know, our model, you know, Kiva's model is a lot like ours in that regard. What we do, though, is measurable in a very different way. Kiva's working with entrepreneurs, right? You're helping to start businesses. We really are working in prevention. What you can look at is what doesn't happen as a result of what we do. And I'll just give you one brief example from the Bay Area. You know, in some cases, these small grants make a tremendous impact. Very quick example, a woman asked for help to, she had been marginally employed her whole life, you know, $8 an hour is the most I think she'd ever made, and she was offered a union job, which would have been, you know, a substantial increase in pay for her. And the union dues for that job, which she had to pay before she could take the job, right? This is always the catch-22 of those jobs, $228. And she didn't have $228. And there's not an organization that you can go to and say, I just got a really good job, but I need $228. Can you help me? So she came to us, and our donors indeed funded that application. And, you know, that was that. Well, 4 years later, I decided I wanted to know what had happened to that person. And we actually work very closely with, we get to know these people. And so I called her up. And I said, what happened to you? I mean, it was really the tenor of the conversation. I told her who I was. I said, well, what happened to you? And she goes, oh, I only have a minute to talk, but I'll tell you what happened. And she says, well, so I got that job, and I worked really hard, and they promoted me 3 times. Then I quit, and I got a better job. And you know, like, and they promoted me 3 times. I quit, and I got a better job. And the reason I can't talk is because I'm on my way to close on my first house, which is a condo in Oakland. You know? So for $228, that was a good investment. You know, what's also remarkable is that about 70% of the people that we help become long-term donors to the organization. So it is very reciprocal. Yeah. And really, the other part of what we do, not just the small grants that we make, but encouraging philanthropy, right? Particularly among people who would not have considered themselves of the means to be genuinely philanthropic. So that's what Modest Needs does.
Cool. Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you, Keith. Thank you, Matt. If you have your note cards filled out with a question, please hand it to Britt over there in the back. And until I receive them, I do have a question for both of you. I'm curious how you, Matt, now that you have U.S. Clients as well as international clients, if you can talk a little bit about how you vet international clients and the difference in vetting U.S.-based clients. And Keith, if you could follow that up in talking about how you determine who gets these little micro grants.
Sure.
Okay, well, with Kiva, we've strived to do exactly the same process in the U.S. that we have internationally, so that there's no favoritism or difference there. The one major difference, though, that we had to accommodate was the fact that loan sizes in the U.S. are quite larger. So with Kiva in the U.S., the maximum loan size you can request on our site is $10,000, which is quite a bit compared to how we started in Uganda when the average loan was about $300. So, but if you look at the sort of the disparity in spending power, it makes sense. You know, poverty is relative, and the power of the dollar is quite different in some places like Uganda versus the U.S. So we had to do that. And if you look at starting a business, it requires so much more capital and so much more process to start a business in the U.S. versus in Uganda, for instance. So that was one of the major differences. But other than that, it's been almost exactly the same.
Thank you.
Well, you know, that's this question. You know, how do you vet these applications? How do you know these people are telling you the truth? I think that's probably the most commonly asked question for people who are new to Modest Needs. And to tell you the truth, it's really not that difficult now that we have technology. You have to think about that neither of these organizations that have changed so many lives could have ever existed in a format that didn't have the internet, really, mm-hmm. could they? I mean, that's it. Can you imagine trying, you know, we've processed per month at Modest Needs, keeping it quiet, we process 3,000 applications a month, right? And you know, we just couldn't have done that if we hadn't had the technology to accept these applications in an online environment. And that's the first thing that we do is we work, I think, like Kiva, almost entirely in an online environment. But in our case, both for donors and applicants, because what we found is that most of our applicants, because we're working with people who say they have jobs, they just don't make enough money to save a lot, right? But they have access to the internet at home, at work. These days, a computer is an appliance. You know, it's like having a radio. So it's, you know, not really the same problem there. Well, what we do is we look at what the applicant tells us on just a, you know, prima facie basis, right? What have they said in the application? And we make an initial determination there based on what they've told us as to whether or not they might qualify to receive one of the specific grant types that we offer if what they've told us is accurate, right? That's the big if, right? If what they've said is accurate. And so what we do is we then request from the applicant, and we do all of this electronically, situation-specific documentation. There are certain things that we get from everyone. We get a copy of a photo ID. We get a copy of, if they rent their home, for example, we have a first and a last page of a lease so that we can verify housing costs, right? It has to be signed by the person who signed the driver's license. I mean, it's all, you know, very, very easy stuff to do, verification of income. And then when it comes to the actual, you know, the situation that the person's working with, the grant making, what we do is we ask for, you know, really we exist to help with extenuating circumstances. In other words, that car repair, right? That we would ask for a copy of the bill to fix the car. In many cases, what happens is that people come to us after they've already incurred the extenuating circumstance. They've already paid for that. Now they don't know how they're going to pay their mortgage, you know, for example. They don't know how they're going to pay for this, you know, X other expense that is a regular expense. And in that case, we have to verify that, in fact, they actually had to pay for this extenuating circumstance. So just to give you a quick example, again, right off the organization's history books, in Maryland, a two-year-old set the drapes of a kitchen on fire in an apartment, right? It happens sometimes. They put the person is completely responsible. They had renter's insurance, all of these things, but there was a $500 deductible on that, and that was the cost of the rent. So she had to pay the $500 deductible to fix the apartment, and then she contacted us to ask for help with the rent. Well, in order to verify what had happened, we asked for all of the standard documents that we get from everybody, and then we asked for a copy of the fire marshal's report. We asked for a copy, you know, proof from the insurance company that they had, you know, she filed a claim and paid the $500.
And I hope you got the matches back from the two-year-old.
I did. Yes, we did. Yeah, well, I think he used the stove. We had to have the place fire-proofed. And then of course, a letter from the landlord that said exactly how much the person owed, and, you know, we verify all of those things. Once we have all of that documentation, we're happy. You know, we're, as far as we're concerned, but you have to remember, this is money that's not even going to go to this person. If we pay, if the donors fund it, it's going to the apartment complex, right? The individual will never see this money. And that's another part of our due diligence. The worst thing that can happen is maybe we pay an electric bill for somebody who maybe didn't need it so bad, right? But that's not usually the case. And so the final step of the due diligence is that in the end, if our donors authorize a grant, then we go and we cut the check directly to the vendor. So we don't pay individuals. Nobody gets cash from us. We pay the bill that they ask for our help to pay. And so that's how we conduct our due diligence here. Does that make sense to you guys?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, well, here's a question from our audience. One for Matt. What precautions do you take when providing access to Kiva funding for borrowers in countries with poor records honoring value of law? I am thinking specifically in countries from the former Soviet Union.
Okay, can you restate that last part again? Sorry, I didn't totally understand the question.
What precautions do you take when providing access to microloans, mm-hmm. Specifically in countries from the former Soviet Union?
Okay, well, I'm not exactly sure what they're getting at there with the former Soviet Union, but
I think the if I'm reading it right, in countries where
there's historically a lot of corruption,
you don't know that the money is actually going to go.
How do you make sure the money gets there?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. That's been tough. You know, we've had to do a lot of visitation and monitoring. So we've had to develop an international staff that goes and visits the microfinance institutions we work with. So just to be clear, you know, in that part of the world, we work in the Ukraine, for instance, and we work with a small bank for the poor there. It's called an MFI microfinance institution. That's like an NGO that's with a mission specifically to service the poor to help them start businesses, and they typically focus on women and often groups of women. And so they take pictures of those women, maybe a group of 10 women together who all need a loan of maybe $500 each. They post it to the site, and people in the U.S. fund the loan, usually really fast, usually within a couple days. And we send the money to the Ukraine. Now the question is, how do we know that the money actually got in the hands of the women on the site? And that's a tricky one. We've had to do, first of all, the most important thing is we pick great organizations that are very transparent and have the systems in place to make sure the money gets there. But second of all, we've had to do a lot of auditing. So we've had to hire international auditing firms like Ernst & Young to actually visit and do random sampling of the borrowers. And we have our own staff. So we have staff that spend a lot of time in that part of the world in Eastern Europe to monitor things like that. And thirdly, we have fellows. So we have over 100 volunteers a year go and live with the microfinance institutions that we work with and help with their processes and help verify that the money gets to where it's supposed to go. Lastly, you know, we've had a lot of situations where we figured out that the money hasn't gotten to where it's supposed to go. We've had about 6 historically partnerships that have totally collapsed. And that's just because we grew so fast that we weren't able to do all that due diligence. And you'd show up to a place a year after you sent, you know, $200,000 there, and you find that the money never got there. And that's a really devastating situation that we've learned to take many measures to try to prevent from happening again. But it's not a perfect world, and stuff like that happens.
That's a good lead into another question. What regulatory oversight is there in the microfinance industry? If none, what looms in the future?
Okay, well, you know, there's a lot of different regulations. It's a quite scattered and disorganized regulatory landscape internationally. Typically, there's a classification of a bank that's not a formal bank, not as official as, you know, Citibank, but also it's different than a charity. It's called a non-bank financial institution. Or a lot of these countries actually have new regulations specifically targeted for microfinance institutions. And the reason they have these regulations is to make sure that the borrowers are protected so that, you know, these borrowers, these poor women are putting their savings in, you know, this African NGO And so how do you make sure that that NGO doesn't totally collapse? And how do you make sure they're protecting that savings? And so the governments of all these countries have decided oftentimes on different regulations to make sure that the organization keeps enough money in the bank so that if it collapses that the poor people can keep the money. And that they're also very transparent. So we have a lot of stories in microfinance of MFIs that are charging too high of interest rates, or they're pretending to charge one interest rate but actually charging a lot more. And then the women don't know that, and so they end up paying like 100% interest, 200% interest over time without much transparency there. And there's a lot of cases in microfinance that are fairly famous around that. So regulators are trying to do a better job of preventing that.
Matt, how have you seen, what kind of a difference or what kind of movement have you seen toward transparency since you started this work in 2004, 2005?
Well, I've seen a lot of work around social performance measurement. In microfinance, when we started, it was just taken as a given that if you give someone a loan, you're helping them. Now we all know from our experience here in the U.S. that that's not always true. Just because someone gave you a loan to do something does not necessarily mean that that's going to help you. It could actually hurt you if you're a person that's not of the means to pay back that loan, or you don't understand the financial implications of taking the loan. So in the last, 5 to 10 years, there's been a lot of pressure on microfinance-related organizations, including Kiva, to measure performance and to develop standardized metrics to measure performance across different countries. So how do you compare an interest rate in India to one in Guatemala? It's a very different landscape with different inflation rates and different currency fluctuation possibilities. And how do you measure poverty in India where being poor means something quite different there than in Guatemala? So we deal in 51 countries, and so we're trying to create a standardized set of measurements that can scale across any country. But we've been trying to do that for a year and a half and haven't made it to the site yet. But hopefully, by early next year, that'll be up there.
Thank you. Here's a question that's come in. Two folks have asked this. It's for both organizations. How do you fund the organization and staffing? Keith, if you can start with
that. Sure. Well, ours is, again, very simple. We do it in two ways. The first thing that we do is we have the best technology possible so that we can work with fewer people. You know, I mean, that cuts costs substantially. But when it comes to actually paying the costs that we do incur, for the last, since 2005, we have been very successful in obtaining operating grants from major foundations who appreciate this work and want the maximum amount of that money to, the money that donors give to go out the door. And so they've funded our costs in full. So for the last 4 years, there has been no overhead cost effectively to the donor, if that makes sense. We hope that'll continue. Obviously, the economic climate has changed substantially, even for major foundations who have had a number of investments tied to the market that have decreased over the last year or so. We don't really know how far that'll continue, but for now, that's how we do it. In the future, what we will do is what many other giving markets do, and that is that we will have a markup, just like everybody else does. We will have a markup on the cost of the application that we'll ask the donors to contribute to. And that markup is what will fund the operation itself beyond the cost of the actual application. Does that make sense? And that's really how you have to do it. I mean, a lot of people don't understand that. I'm sure everybody here understands, but try explaining this to the general public. I mean, nonprofits, for all of the things that they do, are businesses. We incur costs. We can't just call the electric company and say, hey, we did a great thing, so how about we get free electricity? They don't like that. So somebody's got to pay the bills. And what we find is that really our donors, we have historically very open, extraordinarily financially transparent operation, even to the point that you can see our running current year's financials, as opposed to waiting to just see what we did last year. You can see sort of a sketch of where we are this year. And what we find is that if we just tell our donors what we need, typically they give it to us, as long as it's reasonable. Nobody argues if you're just straightforward with a donor and say, listen, we need a printer, we're not going to be able to cut checks anymore. Our donors will give us that in 15 seconds, literally 15 seconds. So, we've had no trouble with that at all. Does that answer the question, I hope, of whoever might have asked it? I hope so.
In terms of how we cover costs, for the first 2 years, Kiva had no revenue streams, so I was just going around asking my parents for a check, my friends for a check, and that wasn't very scalable. I got a little tired. And we hit a point in time where we were actually unable to pay the bills. And so what we did was I took a picture of our building. It's a brick building, and the mission looks fairly run down. And I said, help us pay the rent. And on every transaction, we would send 100% of the money to the person on the site. But then after that, we'd ask for a tip to help pay the rent. And so that started working quite well. And today we pay about 80% of our costs that way. So, we have a staff of 40 and a budget of about $5 million a year now in terms of the costs. And we cover about 80% of those costs through this tip paying mm-hmm. on the site. And the rest is mostly from foundations. So like Modest Needs, going around and raising money from foundations that fund operating costs.
If I could just have a quick follow-up to that, just something that I've learned that I would never have suspected at the beginning. You know what? It turns out that donors don't mind funding your operation if you ask them to. What they mind is funding it not knowing that they're funding it. That's what they mind. And so, of course, I think that one of the great benefits of the work that we do online is that, you know, the level of transparency is just exponentially higher than in a conventional model, you know, as a brick and mortar model, and I have been just astonished at what our donors I think you'd say the same thing. I mean, the very idea that people would give you a tip, you know, for doing this, is just absolutely unbelievable. But they do, and they're happy to do it. But you know, that's the thing. I think that it comes from a mutual trust that you build with the donor, where they know that you're going to do what you said you were going to do. And they're happy to help you fund their costs, because really what we're doing is, you know, you want to contribute to an organization in the, you know, or a person needs a microloan in the third world. You know, who's going to find that? You know, you can't find that, right? I mean, you're tipping the org that helped you. It's been a remarkable experience to see donors respond to that kind of transparency in a world where we can be that transparent finally.
And Keith, do you have any plans to expand your operations worldwide?
That's a great question.
Thank you. Oh, I didn't ask.
Oh, well.
Thank you.
Well, the answer to that question is a qualified yes. All right. Right now, what we really want to do is you have to understand that Modest Needs already is more than I ever imagined that it would be ever. Right? So we've had to work to adjust our model to accommodate the sheer amount of interest that exists in the United States. And that's been the first part of it. And once we're satisfied that the model that we use here is as efficient and streamlined as we can possibly make it, and we can accommodate certain regulatory changes that would have, in other words, you know, it was hard enough working with the IRS here, you know, now I gotta go convince Canada, you know, that this is okay, and then the UK and all of these, you know, these different countries. But will we work worldwide? Yes. Will we work but we'll do our work mostly in developed countries like the United States. I think that's where this need is the most clear. I think Kiva really has done exactly what needed to happen for the third world countries that they serve, especially, and even in the U.S., is a remarkable job. And we won't go into those markets because really there's such a difference. What we did there would not have the same impact or the same effect as what we can do in a developed nation. Really, what we do is a lot like it serves the purpose of a microloan, but in a developed country.
Yeah.
And Matt, here's a question for you. Do you have any plans to make your website multilingual, like Facebook, so you can grow further?
Yes, I have plans, but no time and no resources to do that. So Facebook, they did a great thing, which they opened it up to the community and let the community translate the site. But just building the infrastructure to allow that to happen is quite an effort that we don't have the staff to allow. So it's probably something that'll take, you know, a year or two for us to figure out. But, you know, for instance, I'm going to Japan next week. Kiva is very famous in Japan. We were on this big primetime show in Japan, an hour-long documentary where they followed me and other people around San Francisco studying us, and it was very fascinating. They were very fascinated with us. When I go to Japan,
they should see you now with the red face. They would love this.
This is for them. They're gonna love it. When I go to Japan and speak, hundreds of people show up. Maybe even more than that. We have fan clubs, and we're very popular there. But if you go to our website, no one Japanese uses our website. So it's because it's not in English, and people in Japan just don't use English websites, even if they might love the cause, they just won't use it. Mm-hmm. So there's so much potential out there to be funding projects from Japan, be funding projects from Holland, be funding projects from France, all over the world, that we're just not taking advantage of because our site is in the wrong language, English.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Thank you. And I'm going to combine a couple questions here for Kiva. Mm. They're along the same lines. What about war-torn countries and countries that need immediate relief? Does Kiva have the means to make loans available to people in these countries quickly?
You know, I think we're especially good at that. The internet's especially good at that because you can get money through the internet to places that are fairly hard to reach fairly efficiently. And our user base really loves to support people that are suffering from war-torn political conditions. So our user base doesn't necessarily want their money back, which is a strange thing. They want to know it's going to good use, but they don't necessarily want, they're not striving to get 100% of their money back first and foremost. And so we've been able to work in Iraq because of that. We've been able to work in Afghanistan because of that. We've been able to work in Gaza because of that. Sri Lanka. All sorts of places all over the world, like Kenya after a political crisis as well, all over the world where there was really, a political situation where and other funders weren't able to work there, but Kiva's able to work there because of the internet and because of the very fact that our lenders don't necessarily want the money back.
Thank you. Keith, what is your average grant size and what's the range from smallest to largest?
The average right now is about $550, the very, very small grants. The range generally I think the smallest thing that we ever funded was $17 for medication that a woman needed to not go into preterm labor. I think that was the smallest grant we ever made. As far as the largest grant, I don't know the largest grant would have been to a nonprofit. We eventually we created a grant for nonprofits that were in similar situations to the individual people. In other words, you know, we don't make major grants. It's not a major grant making process. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of great nonprofits that just don't have the resources, the communications resources that we have. And so, you know, there are a lot of you who might want to support, I don't know, an animal shelter, but you don't know that your local animal shelter needs 30 pounds of dog food or they're going out of business. You know, it's that they don't have a way to tell you that. Mm-hmm. And so we created a grant for nonprofits to be able to use our resources to get grants from the communities that they served if, you know, they wanted to do that. And I would say that our largest grants would have had to have gone to a nonprofit because our threshold there is much higher. The maximum is $5,000. For individual people, the maximum is the greater of $1,000 or the cost of 1 month's rent or mortgage. And we had to create sort of a floating maximum there to accommodate people who lived in areas where, you know, that's really one of our most common applications. We need help with rent or mortgage because we already paid something that we didn't expect and didn't know you were around, right? So we had to create that that floating maximum to be able to accommodate people who lived in areas where you really can't rent for less than $1,000, New York being one of those places, right? San Francisco, et cetera. So that's the range.
Little musical interlude here, thank you. Don't you hate that? Matt, this is a question that I've always wondered. I don't know why I've never asked. Where does the name Kiva come from?
Kiva is ostensibly a Swahili word, but I've never met a Swahili speaker that knows the word. It lives in the world of online dictionaries, but not actual vernacular. But in the world of online dictionaries, it means agreement, which appealed to me very, very much when we were picking the name. It was short, nice, easy to pronounce, and had a nice meaning, at least in the dictionary.
That's great. Thank you. All right. Excellent. It'd be nice to get that verified. But
What verified?
That Kiva actually, you know, means that from somebody who speaks the language.
You know, it doesn't. You know, I've I've actually met Swahili professor who didn't know the word.
All right. Well, yeah. it's a good story. I like
Swahili is a strange language. There's lots of words that get tagged on. You know, it's that people don't necessarily say.
It works. So, yeah. Here's another one for Kiva. How much will actually just talk to us about a bit more about the due diligence process? And there's been criticism about not enough due diligence going into these MFIs that are getting money. So tell us a little bit about your process.
Okay. Right now we have a 12-step due diligence process, just like most rehabilitation programs. But you know, it involves a lot of financial investigation. It involves looking at the board structure, the management structure, and the ability of the organization to carry out what it claims to be doing. And then it definitely involves visitation as well, which to me was the number one thing that we were missing early on, was the ability to visit organizations. A lot of organizations look good on paper, but when you show up, the reality is nothing like the paper. So you learn so much when you go and visit. And as an early org, in the first 2 years, we had no budget to travel. So we were doing due diligence over Skype, which wasn't as revealing as in person. So we've gotten a lot better that way.
And ultimately, how do you know that the $150 loan went to buy XYZ for a business?
Well, you know, we don't actually audit that. So we don't actually audit, did this person on the site buy a sewing machine with the loan on our site that was supposed to be bought with the sewing machine? We audit, did the person get the money? And that's, you know, in a world where you're working in 51 countries and sending out hundreds of millions of dollars, eventually it became untenable to check up on that. But at the organization level, definitely checking up on whether they're delivering the loan in the first place.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And Keith, you have two locations, one in San Francisco, one in New York.
That's right.
How did you, why did you ditch Tennessee?
Well, that's not a hard question to figure out. But why I ditched it is not as important as, well, it is. The truth of it was very simple. With, you know, Modest Needs grew very quickly beyond any expectation that I might have had. And so I had to, a lot of people thought I was being the most stupid person in the world. I resigned a wonderful professorship about 1 year from tenure, guaranteed tenure, okay? And everybody thought I was absolutely nuts. And once, but I didn't think so. This is what I wanted to do, right? So I made that decision, and then all of a sudden it occurred to me that Modest Needs could operate from anywhere. You know, I practically go to the Bahamas if I wanted to and operate Modest Needs. So the question then became, where will this organization, to start up, where's the most effective place I could put this organization? Where would it have the greatest access to media? You know, people need to know about the organization. Where, you know, a number of questions like that. And then, of course, personally, where would I like to be? You know, just initially, where would I like to be? And to be quite honest with you, New York has been sort of the home of my heart for many, many years. And to tell you how we got to New York is, this is actually the truth. Our donors found out that that's where I wanted to be, and they relocated Modest Needs to New York. That's what happened. They put us there. And the rest is history.
Thank you. Matt, here's one for you. Could you comment on apparently recently published article talking about Kiva's involvement internationally and then moving into the U.S. and the summary that Kiva should stay in international and not expand into the U.S.?
Sure. You know, it's strange. For years, the main question I was getting, I did customer service for Kiva, and one of the main questions we got, other than people complaining about their loan not being repaid or something, was, why aren't you working in the U.S.? You know, you're serving all these people in the developing world. Why aren't you working in our own backyard? Why do you care about the developing world more than the U.S.? So it was very much coming from our user base that we decided to expand into the U.S. Now, interesting thing happened is when we launched in the U.S. in June this year, we immediately received a big backlash on our site. So there was user groups forming with hundreds of people on our site protesting working in the U.S., basically making the argument that, you know, the people, the money that's going to the people in the U.S. is not serving a need that's equivalent to somebody that's in Uganda or Cambodia, for instance, and that it actually might take away from that cause. And I also receive a lot of mail. So receive, you know, every time I go to my mailbox, receive a batch of letters from people that were upset about that. So it was really surprising. A lot of them didn't have email? A lot of them were European, too. So we're getting a lot of this backlash from people in Europe. So, you know, it was an interesting situation. But what we tried to do is listen to people, make them feel heard, and then react by setting guidelines for, and so let me back up. What we did was we conducted an online poll, and we asked our users, you know, who supports us working in the U.S. Turns out about 60% of them supported us working in the U.S. And then we had a conference call where we asked our users to chime in and give us feedback over the phone. So we had hundreds of people calling in on this conference line, giving us various opinions. It turns out most of them were for us working in the U.S., but a small percentage were against it. But in the end, I think, you know, we won them over by making them feel heard and then telling them that, you know, that there is a need in the U.S. for microfinance, and Kiva really can serve an important role by working here. And it seems to have died down. It seems to be going quite well right now.
And what kind of traction are you seeing in the U.S.?
In the U.S.? It's very small. So we've lent out about $300,000 in the U.S., and that's, you know, Kiva's loan volume this year is $60 million. So our ability to work in the U.S. is quite small compared to other countries. The microfinance sector is not as well developed here, and it's not as clear where the need is greatest. So it's we work with one organization here, one in New York, and are expanding pretty modestly.
All right, thank you. Mm-hmm. And here's another question for Matt. What role do you see older, more traditional microfinance nonprofits such as Acción, Grameen, et cetera, playing in the future? Are they moving to Kiva's online giving model?
I think they've learned a lot from the fundraising strategy of Kiva, and we actually work with a lot of them now. So Acción is our partner in New York, and they've used Kiva to raise awareness. And it's interesting, in the U.S., one way they've really benefited from working with Kiva is by getting loan applicants. So they're getting hundreds of people writing in to their organization saying, I need a loan, and post me on Kiva. So that's been, more so than the money for them, that's been one of their primary interests, is generating marketing and generating awareness by borrowers for Kiva.
Great. And I know that you mentioned that folks online who give loans don't really expect the money back, they just sort of re-lend them. And so, Keith, in your model, how do you see your donors playing a role? Do they continue to grant these small loans, these small grants, or how does that work?
Well, I'll tell you, it's interesting. We have an enormous base of people who give monthly pledges. That's actually been fundamental to how we work. Very small pledges, $5, $10, $25 a month, but they sign up and give that amount every month. And then what we do is they actually have an account with us online, and we credit them. We operate Modest Needs just essentially as a giant donor advised fund, right? So what they're able to do, we give them points for the money that they give us, and each application is valued at points, and you give your points to that application. That's how you tell us you want us to fund that application. That's the best we can do without letting you actually give money to a person, which is prohibited. You know, that's one of the things you can't do in the nonprofit world. So as far as we have an enormously loyal monthly, or biweekly donor base, and a substantial amount of what we do comes from that. We also have, what's remarkable is that the larger contributions that we get come from people who come, they give, say, a couple $1,000 one time. They go through, they fund a whole bunch of applications, they become addicted, and then become a monthly contributor. And so that's really what our base is. You know, I really, again, part of what I want to see happen, it's not just about the big money. I like to see large numbers of people doing what they can. That makes sense. And so, you know, the $25, $30, $40, $50 monthly contribution is, I think, what I'm mostly interested in. I want to see people making commitments to make change where they are, right? And that's how I measure that commitment, is not how many people have given once or twice, but how many people are willing to say, I'll do this every month. You know, this is something that matters enough to me that I'll do it all the time. And that's how I see our base developing.
Excellent. This is for both of you. Actually, I want to start with Matt. Kiva is very well known, and you started sort of suddenly, grew at least in popularity almost immediately. Mm. Can you tell us a little bit about your marketing strategy, or you fell into it by mistake, and what advice could you give to Keith's organization?
Sure, I think they've done a great job too. I've heard a lot about.
He's gunning for Oprah though. You guys have hit Oprah and the.
Yeah. I mean, I just have to throw this in. I mean, this is a big thing, right? I mean, we Modest, even though many of you here have heard more about Kiva than you have about Modest Needs, I mean, here's what it comes down to. If you were to name like the four or five big giving markets, who would come to mind? Kiva, Donors Choose, right? Modest Needs, maybe, depending. But if you name the ones that you can think of, they've all been on Oprah. That's really true. They've all been on Oprah.
How'd you get there, Matt?
Good looks. No.
I believe that.
You know, it was really an accident, and I can't claim a marketing strategy. Kiva's never had a marketing department, so it'd be, without a department, it's hard to have a strategy. But
that was your strategy.
I can look back sort of retroactively and point to some things that made a big difference. Being in the right place at the right time made a big difference. Microfinance was a hot topic in the years that we started, and we just happened to start right before it became a hot topic. Very lucky. Dr. Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize pretty soon after we started. Very lucky. In addition, you know, if I look at things we did, I think we told stories well. So we were blogging about Kiva from day one and sort of pouring our hearts out. We were documenting every trial and tribulation and being very transparent that way. And I think some early media was because of people picking up that story and following the personal story of us starting it, as well as the stories of the people on the site. So always focusing on people first and stories and creating content that was changing constantly and getting other people involved was pretty big for us.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. All right. We have time for one last question. And this is actually a little conversational. Matt, what would you advise? What's your advice for Keith in terms of expanding internationally?
I would say that, you know, one great thing about working internationally for Keith might be the fact that he can get over all these regulations. So if I were him, I would focus on taking the essence of what makes Modest Needs great, which is the personal touch and the fact that you can see someone's need and give them a small amount of money. And you can even do that a lot better when you're working internationally than when you're working in the U.S. Because in the U.S. there's, as far as I understand, a lot of red tape around actually donating to a person that you've had to confront constantly.
Well, you know, that's very interesting. Yeah. That same red tape, I'll tell you what it is, just since you brought it up. It's a regulation that's called targeted giving, right? And it's prohibited by the IRS, and I'll tell you what it is and why, all right? You're not allowed by the IRS to make a contribution to directed towards an individual with the irrevocable demand that your contribution go to that individual. This is why. You and I could make a deal right now that we're going to pay each other's rent through Modest Needs every month. So every month you put in your rent, your mortgage request, I put in my rent or mortgage request, we just pay each other's, right? And then at the end of the year, our mortgages suddenly became tax deductible. Do you see what I mean? That restriction exists in every developed country. So what you have to do is, the way you get around that is by having a donor-advised fund, which means that we retain, and this is part of the, you know, when you, this is why we work in points. When you get the points, you know, what you're doing is making a recommendation. You're saying, as a donor, I'd like to fund this, right? But in the end, if we find out, and we have found out, that, say, you know, person A and person B are next-door neighbors, and, you know, and it's, this is why we do all of our due diligence, we retain the right to go in and say, and veto that. Do you know, we think, no, right? And that's part of, you know, that's a kind of red tape that we would have to confront in every developed country, because everybody has put the put the brakes on targeted giving for good reasons. It is exactly right. But that has been an obstacle that we've had to overcome.
Yeah.
Now, if you're working in, a place where targeted giving is not, not an issue yet, not a problem, right?
Yeah.
But I think most of
other
the places
problems.
That, yeah, there would be other problems,
It's also not usually a problem when you're crossing borders. So if I was funding someone directly in the UK,
mm-hmm.
there probably wouldn't be as much red tape around that.
It's probably true.
If I was in the UK, funding someone in the UK.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And Matt, Keith, advice for Matt as he moves more aggressively in the U.S. market.
Wow. That's a really good question. I have to tell you, I don't have any advice for Kiva in the U.S. market. Yeah, except get ready.
Okay.
that's it. I think that what I would do, because I think that I understand everything that you're saying about the backlash that Kiva experienced when they first came into mm-hmm. the United States, because it was a radical departure from Kiva's original model, right, which was to make micro grants in developing countries. I think the most important thing that you could the service that you're performing in the United States is absolutely invaluable. And more people need to know exactly why you're doing it and what separates that from, say, a loan that you might have made 3 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. Because essentially the folks that Kiva's working with are people who, even under our guidelines, we couldn't help them, right? I mean, it's a bigger chunk of money than we would normally give, and it's to start businesses, really. I think that's what's going on. It's a very, very different type of model. But I think what you'd have to do, I think the primary argument that comes in is, well, there's already credit here.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing as if you made a loan in India where there was no access to credit. There is access to credit
yeah.
here. And I think that my advice going forward would be just to make sure that people understand that, in fact, the people that you work with, there is not universal access to credit in the United States. There is not, And I think that's the one thing that I would just pound over and over and over again. Does that make sense to you guys? I mean, there's not universal access to credit. If there were, neither of us would need to work in the U.S.
Mm.
Exactly. Thank you. And while there isn't universal access to credit, what there is universal access to are websites like
mm-hmm.
Matt's and like Keith's, where individuals like you and me and everybody else can actually make a difference, where you can, with very little effort, with very little money, log on and impact people's lives almost immediately. So unfortunately, we are out of time, but I thank you all for coming, and I thank Matt Flannery for being here, and Keith Taylor very, very much. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm so glad to finally get to meet you.
Yeah.
It was really nice.
It was really nice to meet you too.
All right, so can we de-mic now? Are we done?
Okay.